It's a race against time. Beat the clock. Well, this will be our last section on Demeter and Persephone. And we've got to look at the story, tell the story all over again. Otherwise, we'll just be talking ideas and no story. Demeter is a mother, barley mother. And as a mother, she has the character of a mother. She's mild, gentle, caring, soft, and protective. And only when she's protective is the only time that she's fierce. However, she had to become a mother. And to become a mother, she had to participate in union. And being a goddess, she did that fully. And she enjoyed it, but her purpose was fertility. It wasn't wanton affairs like Aphrodite, but she entered into union to have children. She did with her brother Zeus, and they had Aeacus and various different people. Also, as a mother, she had to suffer sorrow, because all mothers suffer sorrow. And being a goddess, she was vulnerable in few places for suffering sorrow. And the only place that she was really vulnerable was with her daughter, Cor. A mother is always very vulnerable with her daughter, probably because they have that really strong etheric tie that hangs on longer than the tie with the father. It makes it more difficult for women to become, or those in a woman's body, to become completely independent, because they have this natural tie and they hold things together. It's probably also why they're more peacemakers. It's because they recognize the togetherness of us all. Now, mothers learn to never let their children unwatched, and even though her daughter was a goddess, and even though she was a maiden, in fact, that's what her name means, Cor means maiden, she was not to be left unwatched for even a moment. And when she did leave her child unwatched for a moment, Hades took the way that all men take, and in their external separation, the manifestation of unity is a very external thing. Otherwise, why would men fantasize at pictures and objects, right? So Hades lusted after her and found a way to get around the difficulty with his brother and his sister, and he rapes her and takes her down into the underworld. Because Demeter was very attached to her daughter, and because she did everything wholeheartedly, she entered into union wholeheartedly, did all of those things like that, she grieved wholeheartedly. She grieves to the maximum, to the number 9, because the number 10 is a repeat of the number cycle, so she, for 9 days, she grieved. Of course, other men recognize women's weakness, and they sometimes take advantage of them in their weakness. And she has problems with her brother Poseidon raping her, even though she tries to get away from him while she's in the middle of grief. She takes the form of a mare, and he takes the form of a stallion, and she produces a nymph and a wild stallion after that. But grieve as she might, or have troubles that she may have, she still remains adamant in wanting to be with her child. She realizes, as all gods do, that the only way that you develop yourself in evolution is through humility and service. So what she does is she enters into the service of the local king, Selas, and I don't know, Metaneria, I don't know if that's how you pronounce their name. She enters into the service as a wet nurse and takes a very humble position and tries to fulfill it humbly. They don't realize that she's a god. While she's working there, she realizes that humans are human. And in their being human, they're compassionate. And they sense a tremendous grief about her. And they try to cheer her up. All humans do that when they feel someone is down and feeling bad. They try to cheer them up. And some things happen naturally without having to have full knowledge, because she entered into union for the purpose of fruitfulness, and her fruit is now gone. She would have some anxieties about sex. Most people have anxieties about sex, and that's why there are as many sex jokes as there are. We have to relieve them by laughing about it because we have an insecurity. It's probably a whole cosmic insecurity as far as human beings are concerned, going all the way back to the time that we began abusing the sexual function in a selfish way. And so we all have fears of earthquakes, and we all have fears of sexuality because they're tied together. And so what happens is that one of the servant girls and one of the old servants, Bilbo, try to cheer her up by telling her naughty stories and singing her naughty ditties and things like that. And she gets a little bit of relief, but not too much. And because she's distraught, and because she forgets the fact that she's a divine working among humans, she has all of this power. And being distraught, you're more likely to make mistakes. You break more dishes, you drop more dishes when you're upset, you goof more things up, typing goes bad, and such like that. And in her case, she makes a few little mistakes and kills two of the princes. One, she turns into a lizard in a moment of pique. And the other, she's trying to immortalize by putting him into fire, and she gets interrupted, and you dare not interrupt the spell. And that was that. Two princes gone right there. Eventually, her patience pays off, because by hearsay, from witnesses, sort of witnesses, the sons, the pig herd, the shepherd, and the cattle herd, the three of the sons of Selas, she hears about someone being abducted, and she follows her intuition, as you can always understand the truth of a rumor by following superstition. I think the Jungians are perfectly right in saying that rumor is a manifestation of everybody knows what's going on in the subconscious, only they speak it out because they're not given the facts, and they speak out what's going on in the collective subconscious of the community. However, they speak out more things that are in the subconscious than actually come out as fact in history. But at any rate, she comes up with some evidence, and she confronts Helios, who has witnessed the rape, and he says, yes, it is so. And now she really becomes disconsolate, and she becomes adamant. And being in a feminine body, she does what feminine people do, or feminine beings do. masculine being would go to war. She'd go to, right straight to Tartarus and battle with Hades and fight it out. But being a woman, she does something else. She withholds life and she withholds love. And the earth begins to wither. This is the same story, different way of telling it. And the earth begins to wither, and she keeps on holding out, and the gods soon realize that something has to be done, and so they have to, in effect, litigate a solution. And it's not illogical, the fact that marriage and litigation and open enemies are all ruled by the same house. Shows that we're tied together and where justice must come to the fore. And the gods begin litigating and politicking. However, she's a really tough cookie and she won't give in to flattery. She won't give in to gifts. She won't give in to anything but the return of her daughter. And because she loves her daughter, and we know from the Bible that love never fails, she gets her way. And her daughter is to be returned to her on the grounds that her daughter hasn't eaten anything, any of the food of hell. And her daughter, being an innocent young maiden, despising the rape, you can understand that being raped, she would not feel too comfortable being in that kind of a position. And she's about to leave for the upper world when there's somebody who says, what is his name? Far away from the real notes here, or from the old notes. Asclepius. Asclepius says he saw her open up a pomegranate and eat seven seeds. He must have been pretty close by. And he says he's going to stand as witness to it all. And this puts Demeter in an even more horrible place. She's going to get her daughter back, but now she's going to lose her daughter. But she still remains adamant, and she doesn't want to lose her daughter altogether. And there's more litigation until it's decided that she will have her daughter for 9 months of the year above the earth, and then 3 months of the year below the earth. And her daughter will be now called Persephone instead of Cor. And the daughter is very greatly changed. Show me anybody who's undergone a rape, and I'll show you somebody who's very greatly changed. And she comes back a different being. And she comes back with more of a hell-raising disposition. Her name, Persephone, means bringer of destruction, and the 3 months that are associated with her queenship in the underworld are the 3 months that are associated with death and destruction and everything in the earth. So she gets her daughter back, but she can't have everything. Nobody, not even the gods, can have everything. Only the Almighty wins everything, because the Almighty surrenders to everything, and only the Almighty completely wins. And because these are immortals, it isn't a story that happens once. It happens again and again and again, and the cycle goes on and on and on. After it's all over with, at least in the story rendition, or if it were as a single story, Demeter is as richly rewarding to Celis and Metanea as she can possibly be. She grants them all kinds of rich rewards. The most rich being, she teaches her worship to Triptolemus and makes him an agriculturist, which means makes him a hierophant and a teacher of the mysteries. Okay, she gives the fig tree and a bunch of seeds and a number of other things, but that's basically the story. The story as we have looked at it in the past. The first time we went through the story, we just made commentary on little passages of the story. And we talked about little sidelights and such like that. And then last week, or the last time we met, we actually studied the exoteric side of what happened on the 9 days of the public celebration of the mysteries. And I'm trying to get Pam to resurrect the Festival of the Lakes as a celebration of the Eleusinian mysteries, that she could go through all of the different steps that they went through. And I don't know whether she'll go for it or not, but we talked about that celebration and all of the things that happened, and we talked about some of the symbolism of what it meant. And then we talked about the five different ways that the ancient mystery schools and philosophers interpreted myths. We said that the lowest level was a material interpretation, which was just as a simple earth analogy. The next level was an animistic interpretation, in which you studied the myth as it related to the soul. We didn't do an animistic interpretation last week. And then the next level is a physical interpretation, showing how the forces of the cosmos work into the material world, and we did a physical interpretation last time. The fourth and highest interpretation is called the theological interpretation, because it relates to matters of the gods and matters of the divine. And the fifth is mixed, and only the mystery schools used all four in mixed variety. So now this time we're going to look at two theological, or one theological and one para-theological interpretation of the myth of Demeter and Persephone. We're going to go a little bit deeper than we did last time. Unfortunately, when we go deeper, it becomes much more immense and it becomes much more ponderesome. And the feelings and the attitudes that we encounter when we go to a deeper level are much, much more awesome. And to be able to do that, we would have to give it much more time. So we're going to be even more abbreviated this time, doing a theological interpretation. And it's going to be a quasi-epigenetic interpretation, because I'm going to freely create and interpolate. Ah, oh, terrible, terrible. And I'm going to try and go as deep as I can, and I'm going to try and read between the lines on the Platonists. And this is this interpretation, though the Platonists and the other Greek mystery schools usually treated only one half of this. They treat the myth as the story of what they call the soul, which we would call the individuality, as it descends into generation into the material world and as it reascends. And so for them, then, the Demeter represents a very profound spiritual state, and the daughter of Demeter represents an individuality. And she, looking at the material world, is captivated by it and rapaciously taken down into the material world until her grieving mother frees her and she reascends back into the spiritual world. This is the common way that the different Platonistic mystery schools looked at the myth. Since we're looking at it in a Platonistic way, we'll have an also slightly modified statement from the Platonists that is very famous to show how they think theologically or mythologically. And this is what they said about the nature of the what they call the soul, which we will call the spiritual individuality, and how it comes into and out of the material world. They claim that the soul descends chorically into generation, and that it is distributed dionysically, and that it is bound promethiacally into Hadean rapacious greed, and it is freed Hercule, all right, in a fashion like Hercules, and it is collected as Apollo and Artemis by the art of philosophy. So these words of descending, distribution, binding, freeing, and collecting are very specific terms, and they talk about attitudes in the spiritual process of incarnation into the earth and leaving it. In fact, the Platonists are so profound, and I can't find anything wrong about it at all. In fact, it just rings all sorts of bells for me. The Platonists are so distinct in their views of the spiritual worlds that the same spiritual vehicles are called by different names when the spirit is descending versus when the spirit is ascending. Like the desire body, when the body is coming back to rebirth, has a different name than the desire body when it is leaving. And they have totally different attitudes. And they differentiate between the initiate path and the uninitiate path. And they do so in such a way is they say that there is a dual process going on. They say that the earth and nature grasps the soul and eventually lets it go. But that there is at the same time the soul or spiritual individuality grasps the earth and then frees itself. And that these are two totally different processes, such that if we follow the normal path of evolution, the earth will grasp us and let us go, and grasp us and let us go. And it's only when we follow what they call the life of philosophy, which we would call the life of initiation, that you can pass through a different kind of death. And they had different words for different kinds of death. And the kind of death where you voluntarily disengaged yourself from the physical and passed through all the stages of death, and where the spirit let go rather than the matter letting go, this was the process of initiation. It was a death-like process. So we have Kor, who is innocent. And there's something about innocence that it's impressionable and it is attracted to things. And the attraction of this undefiled love of the innocent Kor is what we would call curiosity. And there is curiosity would probably come as some kind of divine necessity. Love is objective, and it has to have something to love. And here is the world with all of its crystallized ignorance, all of the things that need to be awakened and brought to life. And so the descending of core into matter is a process of curiosity. Then it is dispersed because it gets specialized along the way when we leave the spiritual world. The word that the Platonists used was distribution, or the Greek equivalent of distribution. And the powers of the spirit get delineated and specialized and distributed the more deeply that the spirit enters into matter. And it gets bound to the earth. It gets bound by responsibility from the spirit's point of view, not from the earth's point of view, because if Kor descends by love, the love inside of curiosity, then what you love you're responsible for. Just as Demeter is responsible for Kaur, Kaur is responsible for the things of the earth that it has committed itself to. And finally, through acts of service and sacrifice, like Heracles actually ripped his body off of himself in pieces. This is how he raised himself up into heaven. I don't want to go into that. Maybe next year we'll even talk about Heracles and take the 12 labors as an example of heroism. But he did perform heroic deeds of service and sacrifice, and that is what freed him from the world. Because when you sacrifice, when you give all the way through and give everything you have, that's what frees you. You're no longer bound that way. And finally, there is the work of Artemis and Apollo, who collect things back together in their orgiastic work. And we realize that there were two meanings to the word orgy. The common down-to-earth orgy was, in some of the Bacchic mysteries, people got drunk. And they got drunk and they were very revelrous. But in the inner part, it meant the sort of like what the Buddhists call their transcendental transmutation, where they're doing this work in transforming divine things from one divine state to another divine state. Something like that is what the Platonists called an entheastic orgy. Okay, we're going to look then at this Platonistic interpretation, and we're going to give one view of it. And since I'm a modern mystery student, I'm going to give you a different bias than the bias of Plato. And Plato's interpretation and that of the Platonists was somewhat biased. But first, let's look at a few mythical ideas just to get used to them. Kaur is the daughter of Zeus and Demeter. This means to say that if Zeus represents the divine spirit, the will, which is completely universal, and Demeter represents the humans, the life spirit, the divine feminine, the imagination that draws out the will, which is conspatial and contemporal with the divine spirit, the union of that is the individual spirit. That is an individual human spirit, a threefold entity or one. This kind of union was called in mythology and in mathematics by the Platonists, it was called an immaculate conception. She's also Demeter, as we realize, she's also connected with the earth through Hades and through Iasus. And she also has a son, Iachus. And we're going to talk some about that later on. And there are multiple couplings. This is something that bothers people about Greek mythology who don't understand it. The couplings represent unions of principles and creations that result from them. And the mystery schools differentiated three different types of union, and they differentiated them according to Zeus. Zeus mated with his mother, Rhea, according to mythology. And the mystery students were taught that this was a union of a lesser with a greater. And this represented something like a theurgy, that by uniting yourself with something greater, it raises you to a higher level, and that what comes out of that is a noetic type of consciousness and something very, very divine and something that transcends your own ability comes out of that kind of union. He also mated with Hera and Demeter, and instead of being called an inspiration, the first kind of union was called an inspiration. If you mate with an equal consciousness, that is, if you're mating on the plane, sort of like mixing colors together that are on the same plane of consciousness, that is called a production. And in that production, you are manifesting all of the possibilities of the realm of consciousness that you exist in. It's not like you have to go to something higher to transcend with an inspiration so that you can produce something beyond yourself. It's the production is where you're doing things with equal capability. Any number of them, Demeter or Hera. They were both of the sisters he was intimate with. And the last kind of union is this is the one we're going to talk about a lot next time. He was intimate with his daughter, Kor. And from her came Zagreus. And this is a superior with an inferior. When you associate your consciousness with something lower than yourself, you are then creating. And in this sense, Zeus was seen as some sort of a demiurgos, or as the god of our solar system, and that by uniting with Kor, which represents the individual human spirit, from that came many, many individual human spirits, and that was a creation, and within that, all of the manifest universe came about. So there are three kinds of consciousness then to the Platonists and the Greek mystery schools, which were basically Orphic, which we're going to talk about also in the future. The first kind was inspiration, association of consciousness with something higher, production by manifesting all of your abilities on the plane that you're on by uniting with equal principles, and then creation by uniting with something lower. The Greeks also associated this with three different spiritual levels on a much higher thing, and that's on the higher cosmic planes. They associated it with the noetic and the noetic and noeric and the noeric, and they're each three different kinds of consciousness. Okay, in this case, we're just going to look at union of divine spirit and the life spirit to produce individual spiritual entities, which the Greeks called souls. Now, the virgin maiden needs experience. One doesn't say that in a sexist way, but the maiden soul needs experience to become fruitful, and needs that to become creative, and needs to become creative to feed its parents. This is part of the basic part. There's always in creation, there's always a gratitude. Because we have the opportunity to participate in this great work, our parents, be they spiritual or material, give us, they bestow us a very great gift. As a consequence, their consciousness and their creative powers working in us, as we become like them, or as we come into our own, we feed them. Because the transcendent, as we said of love, needs experience and it needs things to be created, but it can't do that by itself, and that by producing children, the children feed the parents. This is a notion that has very much entered into human culture, and in some cases has been very much taken advantage of. In some cases, it was necessity. Sometimes the only way you could survive in a world is to have a big family. So there is this divine love, and this divine love, you could say, is a self-love, because in the degeneration of an individuality, what you're doing is seeing all of the universal principles that are all over the cosmos. You see them now reflected into a self-conscious being, into a self, into an I am kind of consciousness. And this love of creation carries on to the child, and as we said, that love is called curiosity. It needs something. There's sort of like an unconscious drawing power within the ignorance of nature. I believe that Socrates was right when he said that the underworld is not a place to be abhorrent of, but that the underworld is a place that's filled with treasure. You know, like spelunkers or miners or people like that. I had a friend that he walked across the Catalina Mountains in Arizona at one time, and he ran into an old-timer that was 80-some years old. And every day he went out and he prospected for gold and kept a mule and smashed holes in the ground with those big rods like that and dynamited and kept looking for gold. And he'd lay in bed at night and he'd dream about where he was going to find gold. And the next day and he'd wake up and he'd be out there charging out at sunrise. He was 80 years old. And he was in magnificent health, and he was, in some ways, he told my friend, he says, I think my life is a failure because I haven't found gold. And it was that kind of a thing. So this draw, if you see it from the bias of someone who is longing to be in the spiritual worlds, this drawing power of matter with all of its wealth in it, for somebody longing to be back with the divine lover, is seen as a rapaciousness, as a greed that the soul is abducted. And it's sort of like saying, oh, my mother's child was taken away from me. And this is the way the Platonists looked at it. I don't think that's quite exactly the way to look at it, but it's there's something that... there's something that is appealing, and there is a good amount of truth in it. There were flowers at the scene of abduction, which represent, and they were left scattered on the ground, the handful of flowers that she had. And that means the loss of innocence, because flowers represent a kind of generation that is done completely in innocence. It's either the wind or the insects that do the pollination, and they become fruitful in complete innocence. Okay, now we're set to talk a little bit about the interpretation. We're going to go back to some of the things that we talked about with the 9 days of the outer celebration of the mysteries, but we're going to talk about the ladder or the highway to heaven. We got to throw something something Hollywood in there. First, we have the Milky Way, or this is called galactic consciousness. Then we have the realm of Saturn, and we have the realm of Jupiter, and we have the realm of Mars, and we have the realm of Sun, and we have the realm of Venus, and we have the realm of Mercury, and we have the realm of Moon, and finally we have the sublunary sphere of the Earth. And these represent the nine steps on the ladder of the gods. And if you're descending, the moon is seen as the deadly eighth sphere, because after the moon you fall into generation. And going the other way, Saturn is seen as the eighth sphere, and you have to get beyond the idea of selfishness and the law to free yourself from the cosmos to get back to the divine. Okay. These can be, but I don't want to do that because it would get way too complicated. In fact, it would have taken me a few more weeks of study to put this all together. These different planetary spheres can be associated with different levels in the inner worlds. And, usually the etheric realm extends just beyond the moon and such like that. But I don't want to get into that. What I want to talk about is the stages of the mysteries that we mentioned last time. We talked about the five mathematical arts last time and what they were to the mystery schools, to both to the Pythagoreans and the Platonists, and how they related to stages of the mysteries. First, there is purification, sacrifice. I'm putting them generally in the area where they're associated with the apoptic. Is that right? Oh, there's another P in there. The apoptic, the investiture, and finally there is communion and revelation together. If you remember, in last time when we talked about the 9 days of the mystery, the first day was called Augurmos. It was called assembly or synod. And if you remember, the thing that they were showing on the, we're going to look at this going down and going up. The last thing that they were showing physically as external symbols in the period of communion and revelation, they were shown two jars. And one of those jars was shaped like a sphere. Another of those jars was shaped like a cone. The one that was shaped like a cone was filled with the goods of the earth. And the one that was shaped like a sphere had implements that represented the divine as well as the generative forces in humans. Now, Plato in the Timaeus, which talks about reincarnation physically, reveals the meaning of these two bowls, and it relates to what we're talking about. Augurmos or collection means that when you are in the state of divine consciousness before coming to birth, you are like the divine. Your consciousness is universal. And the universal spirit, which in each of the different dimensions was always perfect, was symbolized by the spherical bowl. But when it is time for reincarnation, there is a collection of thought, a concentration of thought. And then the spherical bowl gets pulled off center to the shape of a cone. In the modern Western schools, like the Rosicrucians, it's described more like a diving bell. That the center of concentration is at the pointed end of the pointed end of the bell, and then it just comes down through the spiritual worlds into the material. It's amazing how much the modern mysteries were there in the ancient mysteries, literally all there. So the purification that allows us to take the step from the galactic consciousness of the that we all have in between lives, that purification is just like the word synod. It means all of our consciousness is brought to a point. And when it's brought to a point, the whole cycle of generation is started all over again. Because to these people, the point represented the basic being that does the generation. And then it becomes a line or a side, and then it becomes a plane or a figure, and then it becomes a solid. The whole of generation was shown mathematically in that way. And I think that's a really good example for purification, because if your consciousness gets set on one thing, it's purified from everything else. And that's the kind of urge that one has when coming back to birth. No matter what the angels of destiny might say to you, I want you to take this kind of life and this kind of life and this kind of life. You say, yeah, I'll take it, because you're concentrated and you're focused on one thing, and that is coming back to manifestation. Okay, then the second day was called Aledi Miste, meaning to the sea. We're covered now, we're starting to lose our consciousness, and everybody was taken to the sea, or in Pammy's version, it will probably be the shores of Lake Mendota. And everybody was taken to the sea to be purified, to be washed. And this is the day they also had the pig slaughter. The outer people had to sacrifice something physical. Surely the initiates didn't. The region from Capricorn through Pisces was called the sea, and sometimes it was called chaos. Especially deep in Pisces, it was called chaos. And Saturn was called the gateway to chaos. Each of the planets is associated with each of the elements at some time or another, and this is where Saturn is associated with water. This is like entering in. My burden of sin I drag behind me. Okay, I'll try to speed up a little bit, because otherwise it'll get way too long. The sacrifice of the pigs. In one sense, the pig has always been considered the being of divine wisdom, because they really get pot-bellied. In fact, Buddha supposedly died from eating pig meat, from pigging out on pig meat. And the ancient knights, at night they were allowed to go into the temple with the gods, and they all feasted on boar's flesh. The reason for this is because in some ways animals are opposite from humans. What humans take out of the stream of creative energy that they have, and they even take it out of their fecal matter, the spiritual creative part, and that gets put into the head for building, again, this is the sphere, the head is, the skull is the spherical bowl, and it gets put into there for developing a center of intelligence for the manifestation of the spirit. Animals, with their creative energy, cannot yet develop the individual brain mind. So what they do is they put the energy out the other end, out the tail, with the wagging of the tail, and with in their fecal matter, which is why animal fecal matter, except if they become pets, then their fecal matter loses its fertility because they become too humanized. And the excess goes out in the fecal matter and in movements of the tail. The rest goes as spiritual wisdom in the body rather than in the head mechanism. And pigs, because they put so much into the body, they were considered very divine beings because they had solidified that much of the spiritual matter. It's quite an interesting thing. It's interesting too, because the pig then puts it all in the body and has a little tail. has a very little tail. And you know that the pig has a corkscrew tail very often. Even the male pigs even have a corkscrew member, which is rather unusual. It makes for great caution. All right. With the sacrifice, they're put to work. The third day was called Sacrifice in Tears, and people were given mullet and barley. The precipitation of thoughts when one is going from a more abstract consciousness and into the physical, the precipitation of thought is what is associated with Jupiter. And the third day, the Jupiter day, and this represents all thought as we know it in our sinful nature, having sunk more deeply into matter than was intended, all thought in the physical body becomes crystallized pain. And when it says, by the sweat of our brow, or you can say, by our tears, is the way our thought work is done. And the sacrifice that we make is by taking our creative energy and putting it into creative thoughts to produce not only our little world in the body, but in the world itself. And so these thoughts were associated with the grains of barley that were eaten. I even eat barley for supper tonight, just in honor of Demeter. And the fish, the mullet, were like the bladdered vehicles that had an internal equipoise. And the internal equipoise that comes from the cool, calm collection that is associated with being mentally self-possessed. You might say that this third day of the mysteries, as we've been hinting at and saying that the Gospels have all of the ancient mystery celebrations right in them, the feeding of the fishes and loaves is identical with what took place on the third day of the mysteries thousands of years before the coming of Christ. The fourth day was called the Grand Procession. People carried baskets, woven baskets, and in these baskets were sesame seeds and carded wool and salt and pomegranates and poppies. And they also carried thyrsi, which were caduceus of mercury. They were wound with ivy being associated with Saturn, and having to do with the history or the extension, where point by point we go through an evolutionary process and remember it, it becomes our soul history. And instead of having serpents, they wound ivy, then saying that this is a process of a historical experience. And there was fruitfulness in that at the top of the thyrsi there were grapes, and also at the top there were bound little tiny pine cones. And the mystery students know that the little tiny pine cones were associated with the pineal gland, and that the grapes were associated with the fruitfulness that came from it, the grape being probably one of the more circular of all fruits. What we're talking about, this is, we're coming from